surge of some kind. But Steve had died of heart stoppage after a cerebral occlusion. Still a stroke, but the opposite kind, where blood stops flowing into a vital part of the brain. And technically the stroke didn't kill him. His heart stopped a moment later, and the medic wasn't able to get it going again. I didn't see any way the machine could have caused it, but of course the medic, Dr. Dvorkin, was not very interested in our opinions, necessarily unobjective. 12 of us squeezed into a small room to watch the data stream analysis. It was pretty straightforward. Steve's parameters looked normal until 20:11:44, when both his heart rate and blood pressure began to soar. In 6 seconds, his pulse went from 72 to 188, and his blood pressure from 105/72 to 310/150, and then spiked so high the biosensor reset itself. His heart stopped at 20:11:51. Everybody was pulled at 20:12:02. Nobody else's parameters showed anything out of the ordinary except for Rebecca. Her blood pressure went way up for a moment when she was pulled, but that wasn't surprising. Normally, the monitor will warn you, like the phone call Bruce and I got in Philadelphia last week. Getting pulled with no warning is like someone sneaking up behind you and clapping his hands over your eyes. But it's not just vision, it's everything. Bruce came in halfway through the presentation, pale from watching the autopsy. After the numbers, we all moved into a meeting room down the hall that had a big table and tea and coffee. "You're not going to say your time machine is exonerated," Dworkin said while people were pouring coffee and tea. "Different cause of death." "Not at all," I said. "Two people have died, and they both died in the machine. If they'd both died in an elevator, we'd be taking the elevator apart." "So we have to go in and investigate," Bruce said, "before anybody else is allowed in." "Forgive me for saying that's absolutely insane," Dvorkin said, answering Bruce but looking at me. "If it were an elevator, we would close it down and use the stairs." "Why do you have to go inside to investigate it?" a male medic asked. "Isn't there some way you could plug a keyboard into the thing and type in questions and throw its responses up on the wall?" "Could you plug a keyboard into a patient's navel and type, 'What's your problem?'" Bruce said. "It's not made for slow digital input." "A couple of hundred years ago," I said, "with the earliest virtuality machines, you could have done something like that. The only input this one responds to is empathic circuitry." "I know that," the medic said. "It reads your mind and body and produces a mathematical cognate. It changes the cognate 100 times a second and imposes those states onto your so-willing body and mind." I didn't recognize him. "You don't use the machine, do you?" "No way in hell. I'm content to be what I am." "You and 15 other people, Edison said. "It's part of what we are. It's no more unnatural than a book or a play." "I don't do it anymore," Dvorkin said, "ever since I was assigned to it. Unnatural doesn't bother me. The high probability that it's killing people sort of dampens my enthusiasm." She pointed a finger at me. "Even you have to see that there's something seriously wrong with the way we are, our attitude toward the time machine. That referendum, 6 out of 7 of us say, well, it might kill us, but it's too much fun to give up." "For whatever it's worth, I've set a date for a new referendum now that we know about Earth, the mortality statistics." "Good for you. And I don't think fun really describes what goes on in the machine. It's not a toy. It profoundly changes the lives of everyone who uses it." "You're exactly right about that, but you could have said the same back in old 20th about opium or heroin, about cigarettes." "Come on, that's so simplistic. Jacob, I'm not the enemy here. I like you. I've liked working around you, but you're not sane about the machine. Most of our culture is addicted to it, and no one more than you." "All right, you could make a case for that, depending on how you define addiction." "There are standard definitions." "Am I addicted to oxygen and water and food, to sex and socialization, to the accumulation of knowledge and the creation of art, visiting other worlds to understand my own better? I need all these things. Where does your definition draw the line? Harm, she said. Wouldn't you say that doing something repeatedly in spite of knowing that it will harm you is not reasonable? I'd say could rather than will harm. I've been running virtual environments for more than 200 years with only 2 casualties. 2 deaths, Jacob, in 2 weeks. If you could hear what you're saying... Okay, I'm overstating my case. The male medic cleared his throat. This has been a horrible day for all of us. We shouldn't be arguing. We need rest and reflection, the company of loved ones. He put a hand on Dworkin's knee, and she looked at it. Then she covered it with her own hand. Jacob, he said, you won't be taking any new clients until you hear from Earth. No, of course not. So we can just let the matter rest for 2 weeks. Yes, I said. Thank you. Dworkin's lips barely moved. In 2 weeks, I'm going to suggest to the Public Health Committee that the machine be destroyed. She looked at the other medics. Not immediately. We have to determine how to deal with people's addiction once the machine is gone.
But you can't. Save it, Jacob, the male medic said. There will be time.
20. Conspiracy. The new referendum, after Steve's death and the bad news from Earth, generated a lot of heated debate. But when it came down to a vote, the machine didn't lose. 560 for keeping it, 201 for shutting it down, the rest undecided. For most people, it seemed to be a rights issue rather than addicts being hungry for their fix no matter what. We did a survey of people who had appointments and found that most of them, 82%, would rather put it off until the machine was certified safe. I sent that information over to Dworkin, suggesting that it might make the destruction of the machine premature, and got the expected reply. It doesn't really change anything, given what we know. Well, given what I knew, or at least suspected, I might be her most enthusiastic ally, at least in that the machine should be dismantled and rebuilt at a less sophisticated level, before it did emulate Arthur and actually start to run everything, if it wasn't already. I didn't want to communicate my fears to anyone via mail or even unguarded conversation. I sort of kept an eye on Bruce and waited until I could maneuver him into a situation where we were unlikely to be overheard by the machine. The day after the referendum, we had lunch together in the mess. The bread was dry and tasteless, someone's unsuccessful experiment, and I suggested we take ours down to the park and see whether the ducks would eat it. I thought you liked them now, he said, but got up and followed me to the pond. A lot of people had the same idea. The ducks liked it, probably as much for the squabbling as the bread itself. I waited until we were relatively alone and said quietly, "You're going to think this is paranoid." And that would surprise me? You remember I wrote to J.B. about what's new in artificial intelligence? Jay the Beard, yeah. What did he come up with? Code. A really deep code that only I would see, that even the machine wouldn't see. I rapidly sketched in what I thought the message meant and what I feared. He nodded while I talked, both of us tossing bits to the ducks. His response was almost a whisper. So the next time you go in, the machine will know what you suspect? In detail. And I assume it read J.B.'s letter beforehand. Might have even decoded it. He shook his head. Could be very dangerous. For you as well as me now. You know everything that I do. Thanks. So what do you plan to do? Go into Wild Year and find out. You monitor me. We're both going in together. No can do, amigo. If it does attack me, if I die in there, you have to pull the plug. You're the only other one who knows the whole story. If I die, that proves it's true. So when do you plan on us doing this conspiratory act? Now. Why wait? You promised the medical... I promised we wouldn't do any clients.
Are you clear on the shutdown procedure? He nodded and threw the rest of his bread to the ducks. Best done quickly, he whispered. Wild Year 1968. The helicopter thrummed through humid jungle air, treetops rushing just below the skids. 3 seconds, the door gunner shouted over the din. I'd been in this template before, South Vietnam after the Tet Offensive, 1968. I had on grungy jungle fatigues, crisscrossed with bandoliers of ammunition, heavy steel pot on my head. I was sitting in the door of the slick with two other guys who were holding M-16s at port arms. Three more sitting in the door behind me. One of them was Lowell. He gave me a thumbs-up sign, and I returned it uncertainly. This was supposed to be Wild Year, but I was on a vehicle with one of my template characters. I felt in my pocket from the outside. No black box. My M-16 was slung awkwardly over my shoulder, and I had two heavy metal boxes of 7.62mm ammo, one on each side. Combat assault. The chopper swept down into a sudden clearing, prop blades hammering. Rose-colored smoke plumed up from one side of the clearing. The door gunner opened up on the other side, cyclic rate of fire. Go! Go! The six of us jumped, and the chopper took off like a startled bird. We fell too far. What had looked like the ground, 6 feet below, was actually the top of a field of elephant grass, another 6 or 8 feet tall. I hit hard, sinking to the tops of my boots in mud, then pitching forward into it. I dropped both ammo boxes, and my M-16 nosed into the mud. Tiger One, I shouted, looking around for the second ammo box. Tigers 2 through 6 answered, shouting over the din of machine gun fire. I couldn't see any of them through the dense wall of grass. Then Lowell came slogging through, carrying a box of ammo and a muddy case of Budweiser. That way, I think, he pointed with his chin toward the machine guns yammering. Cover fire, of course. As if to reinforce that, a couple of M-16s added their pop-pop-pop to it. If it were the enemy side, it would be the louder, deeper AK-47 report. I started to say something about Charlie having plenty of M-16s when there was an impossibly loud explosion just to our right, so close the shock wave of it hammered through me. Lowell spun around, half his face gone, his right arm off at the elbow. Blood spurted from the stump and an artery in his neck. Brains slipped in a stringy mass from under his shattered helmet, and he slumped into death. Another nearby explosion. A mortar, of course. The enemy had the small area psyched. Had I ever seen a template character die? Another explosion distracted me, and when I looked back, he was gone, disappeared, just the ammo box and the case of Bud. I slogged as fast as I could toward the covering fire. Finally, I saw them, up on a berm, shooting from under an improvised bunker of sandbags and logs. I waved frantically, and the loader saw me. He hit the gunner on the shoulder and pointed and waved me in. I scrambled up the berm and rolled into the relative safety of a trench that had been hacked out behind it. There were 4 or 5 other soldiers lying or squatting in the trench. 2 of them bobbed up and took random shots, then squatted down again. I hoped they were aiming high. I dropped my rucksack and carried the ammo boxes over to the bunker, duck-walking like the Marines on Tarawa, and slid them in next to the loader. 5 more people, he shouted, not looking at me, coaxing the belt of 7.62 into the M-60's jumping receiver. Only 4. 1 bought it when those mortars came in. Shit. Only 4, pig, he shouted. Try not to hit him, he said, squeezing off bursts more or less randomly, just above the grass. A mortar blew about 40 yards out, a puff of smoke out of the grass, then a sharp report. He sent a stream of fire through the small cloud, hosing left and right, up and down. Fuck you, fucking Charlie, he screamed, shell cases clattering all over. The other 4 came in quickly, in 2 pairs. The gunner saw them and stopped. That's it, Pop, he shouted to the left. Roger that, cease firing, he said unnecessarily.
The loader crawled back down.